This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Later on, the 10th anniversary of welfare reform, or is it? But first, Mexico. As the courts completed a partial recount of the votes in last month's presidential election, the leftist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador vowed to keep up a campaign of civil disobedience against the government for years, if necessary, to protest what he maintains is election fraud. And joining us from Mexico is Jill Freiberg, filmmaker, and John Gibla, a writer who has looked at the issue of the elections for Z Magazine and Left Turn, and we'd like to welcome both of you to Building Bridges. Let's begin by the situation in Oaxaca. Jill, it's my understanding that women in Oaxaca have taken over a television station. There has also been reported a shooting death. I don't know if that is confirmed or not, but can you take us to the situation on the ground and tell us what the catalyst for that takeover was and how it is proceeding?
The takeover of the television station was one action out of many that have taken place as part of a popular movement that emerged in June out of what started out as a fairly regular annual teachers' strike and which exploded into a statewide popular movement when the very unpopular governor sent in the state police to attack the teachers' encampment at 4 o'clock in the morning when they were all sleeping in the streets with their children. And what happened after that was that a large number of organizations from around the state formed a popular assembly and joined the teachers in a movement which became not so much about meeting the teachers' demands, became a movement calling for the resignation of the governor, and that has been carrying out a variety of actions and marches, including a couple of what they're calling mega marches, where over 500,000 people were in the streets of Oaxaca City. And women who had been participating in the movement decided that there were more ways for them to participate in the movement other than just being in the encampments and bringing food and bringing coffee to the protesters, and decided to call their own march, where they would take to the streets with their kitchen tools and make a lot of noise with their kitchen tools and show that they had more to bring to the movement than what they could do in the kitchen. And at the end of that march, several hundred of those women spontaneously decided to take over the state-run television station, which was also a direct response to profound frustration throughout this popular movement with the mainstream media's pro-government coverage or absolute lack of any coverage of what's been unfolding in Oaxaca. It was a decision to take the tools of the media into their own hands, and they peacefully took over the television station, which also operates an FM and AM radio station, and continue maintaining control of that station and are regularly broadcasting.
It's actually very exciting that they're actually broadcasting. How long has the takeover been in progress?
The takeover happened on August 1st.
That's incredible. How have they been able to sustain themselves? It would seem to indicate that there is an enormous outside support and a reticence on the part of the government to really contest the protest.
Well, they're sustaining. I mean, they've sustained themselves, yeah, with a large outpouring of support. I mean, there's a lot of teachers and other movement participants who are camped out outside of the station to protect the station. There's also the constant stream of neighbors who are bringing them food and coffee and other supplies. There's people who know a thing or two about radio and television technology who've committed themselves to be there every day to help with the broadcast. And then on the other side, one of the objectives of this movement was to create what they're calling ungovernability in Oaxaca. And one sign that that ungovernability is actually happening is that the women have been able to maintain this station and maintain their broadcast at any time of the day or night. There's a large number of teachers up on the hill where the antennas are, guarding the antennas so the state can't cut the broadcast from that angle. It's incredible.
And was there actually a death? Is that a correct report that we got?
Yeah. No, I mean, the governor's response to the situation in Oaxaca, he's called on the federal government to send in the federal police or the army and has gotten an unfavorable response from them, partly due to the national election context, which John can talk about a little bit more. So his approach has been instead to send in people to carry out random acts of violence, which until last Thursday were mostly carried out against the different media outlets that are either part of the movement or that have been favorably covering the movement. And those have been non-fatal attacks where people were often shooting into the air until Thursday when plainclothes police, we're not sure if, you know, from which police force, but plainclothes men entered the march and shot directly into the crowd. And one man who's the husband of a woman teacher who works on the outskirts of the city was killed.
Well, let's now also turn to John, who is with us. And there were reports of not only mass protests that continue and clearly are virtually cutting Mexico City in half, but they're also expanding. And Obrador gave quite a fiery presentation, maintaining that it would be an indefinite period of protest until such time as there is a rectification of what he alleges as fraud. So what is your sense of what actually is happening there?
First off, the explicit focus of López Obrador's protests that have come in mass waves since the anomalies around counting the votes on July 2nd has been the focus on a vote-by-vote recount. They have been channeling all of their energy into this single demand that the Electoral Tribunal, which has the last word on the elections here in Mexico, authorize and conduct a vote-by-vote recount. Well, about 2 weeks ago, the tribunal came out and said that they were only going to count 9% of the total votes. And they had a justification for this, which was that complaints submitted by López Obrador's party, which is the Party of the Democratic Revolution, only explicitly challenged with evidence these 9%, which is about 11,000 different polling places. So they authorized the recount of those explicitly challenged polling places, but not all. They didn't allow the PRD party to generalize out of their explicit challenges. López Obrador's response to that was very emphatic. We won't accept this. We're still continuing in the demand for a vote-by-vote recount. As the 9% recount has been underway over the past week, an incredible series of anomalies have been confirmed in even this small sample of a vote count, which through an outside eye seemed to construct pretty solid evidence that there was systematic tampering in the vote counts. They've got 70% of the votes that have been recounted. They see a systematic chopping off or adding on of votes as they've gone through. As it looks like both the tribunal and the federal government are going to try and force through this election, López Obrador is opening the possibility from not only this demand for a vote-by-vote recount, but trying to broaden the political scope of the mobilization that he's convoked. So starting to talk about connecting it to institutional reform and fighting poverty and the very things that were the subject of his campaign. But as it looks like the government's going to try and force through this election without a vote-by-vote recount, he's opening the possibility that his mobilizations could link to the very political issues of his campaign and extend out over time.
One of the things that was supposed to happen, and I was wondering if it did take effect, is the business community in Mexico City, as a counterattack, said that it would begin to withhold taxes, which of course would go directly to strike at Obrador. Has there been any indication that such an effort has been engaged?
I've only seen the threat so far, but I haven't seen coverage of implications of that threat or to what extent that's going to take action or when. Another curious feature about the protests, and just for those who don't know, since July 30th, López Obrador called upon his supporters to set up camps in the national square, the town square of Mexico City, which as the federal district kind of symbolically is the very core, the political heart of the country. They've set up a major encampment completely occupying this town square and then also extending out through three different avenues, one of which, Reforma, is one of the principal thoroughfares in the city and is also, again, symbolically, it's the wide street that marches always take. So it has both a very powerful symbolic punch that they've occupied the political core of the country, but also it has a very real punch for a lot of working class people that they've tied downtown in a knot and made traffic pretty impossible.
To what extent will the tension that is created by legitimate protest and aggressive civil disobedient spoil over and create a real antipathy that results in greater levels of violence provoked by government policing forces and so on? Is there any sense that we're at that precipice? Yes.
The threat of violence is constant, and even probably much more so. Well, not even in Oaxaca, it's not a threat anymore. It's a consummate action. I mean, they've already unleashed pretty serious violence in Oaxaca. But I would say that both in the cases of Oaxaca and the protests of electoral fraud, these are not just spontaneous combustions of social unrest. These are tapping into years and years of economic injustice and repression on behalf of the state. That's why leaders, in the case of Andrés Manuel, and movements without leaders, in the case of the Popular Assembly in Oaxaca, are able to convoke so many people in such short notice into the streets, is because these are manifestations of deep social unrest, which means I don't think they're going away anytime soon. And the hope will be that effort to stick to civil disobedience that's nonviolent and then demand dialogue efforts will be triumphant, and not the, you know, age-old practice in Mexico of sending the police or the military to simply quiet or quell, stomp out popular protests. One reason I don't think they can do that right now is because, A, the sheer number of people filling the streets, and then a couple of, you know, embarrassing things, like Mexico just got appointed to the United Nations Human Rights Commission, and it wouldn't look too good to have them filling their own streets with the army and shooting people. But also, I think the fact there are so many people in the streets is to the advantage of the civil disobedience participants.
Going back to Oaxaca in a manner of speaking, Jill, you've been documenting the activities of the teachers in Oaxaca for some time now. As I mentioned, you are a filmmaker. Help us understand the coalescence of this women and what has clearly been an upsurge and tremendous activity on the part of many in the working class, numbers of struggles that has transpired within the last year or so within Mexico.
Well, I can speak more specifically to Oaxaca. I mean, Oaxaca is one of the poorest states in Mexico. It's one of the most indigenous states in Mexico. It has a very long history of living under very repressive state governments, consistently under the control of the PRI, and so, well, still under control of the PRI at the state level. And it's also the location of where the history of the teachers' movement has always been the strongest. And when you talk about teachers' movement, you're talking about a movement that has members, and, you know, every community in the state has at least one teacher. And it's a movement that, when it started out, had incredible popular support. Many of the teachers who participated in the movement were also participating in community struggles. And I think the catalyst this year, there were a lot of factors involved, but one of them was that the current governor, who's only been in office for 18 months, has earned himself so many enemies in so short of time. On one hand, by just carrying out outrageous public spending on unsolicited so-called civic projects, and less public spending in terms of a lack of transparency on campaign financing and that sort of thing. And, you know, the repression in the state of Oaxaca, which is state repression, has always been profound, but that also accelerated since this governor, Ulises Ruiz, came into office 18 months ago. But there was just so much discontent and dissent in the state that the governor's attack on the teacher strike and failure to negotiate whatsoever with the teachers was a catalyst, and especially within the context of the presidential elections, with Mexicans all over the country really wanting to see a change, a lot of them having felt betrayed when they thought that in 2000 that the fall of the PRI and the entrance of Vicente Fox actually meant that there was some democratic change was coming for Mexico. And then that there has been a series of state repression against legitimate social movements just in the last few months, starting with the mine workers at the steel plant in Lázaro Cárdenas, Michoacán, where the state and federal police were sent in and opened fire on the strikers, and then the situation in San Salvador Atenco in the state of Mexico in early May, which was a profoundly brutal demonstration of state violence, both at the federal, state, and municipal level, that has just been creating this incredible tension between legitimate social uprising of movements in different states who have had it, and what the current PA, the current PAN candidate, Felipe Calderón, who's claiming that he won the presidential election, calls mano dura, which is, you know, basically the strong arm of the law, the tension between that and these legitimate social movements.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but perhaps Mexico can accomplish what we weren't successful in, which is both revealing the fraud of an election and seeing that the popular elected candidate really does assume office. And again, Jill Freiberg, filmmaker, and John Gibler, we'd like to thank you very much for joining us on Building Bridges. Well, yes, the greedy do live off war, and the poor do indeed seem to get poorer. With us now is Dr. Avis Jones-DeWeaver, who is Director of Poverty, Education, and Social Justice Programs at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. And we are going to take a look at the 10th anniversary of welfare reform. Well, we'll find out more about that. Well, you stated recently that lost amid all of the 10th anniversary celebratory discussions that equate caseload reduction to welfare reform success is the ongoing reality that families continue to live on the margins, struggling to make it, and in recent years falling further and further behind. So welfare reform success, tell us more.
I'm based in Washington, D.C., and it's been very interesting in recent weeks to see Congress patting themselves on the back, talking about a job well done with regards to welfare reform, sort of lauding victory as a result of dramatic drops in caseloads. What they don't talk about so much is the fact that poverty has been rising every year since 2000, that over 5 million more people are poor today than were the case back in 2000, and that the average poor person's income is further below the poverty line than at any time in history since we've started collecting that statistic, and that's been about 30 years now. So they're not really telling a full and accurate picture with regards to the true impacts of welfare reform. And the true impact, as I see it, is the fact that more and more families are being left further and further behind.
We're really dealing with smoke and mirrors. So let's continue to delve into the nitty-gritty. There is a dramatic drop in caseloads, and I can speak as a legal aid lawyer who deals with public benefits all the time, and I know why. And there are roadblocks and obstacles, dramatic increase in poverty. So really, what is happening? How do we debunk some of the mythologies about poverty? And why are some groups able to rise above the poverty? Is there a racial factor? What is actually demonstrated through your studies?
Well, it seems as if under welfare reform, there was a general shift in the way we thought of how we might provide assistance to America's most impoverished citizens. Prior to welfare reform at the AFDC, we had what I would call a social safety net system. Basically, we made a value statement as a nation that there are certain levels below which we do not believe individuals should be forced to subsist. And so we had this basic safety net that provided at least a level of subsistence for individuals who were at the margin. Under welfare reform, we shredded that safety net and said no more will we have that. Instead, we're going to have a five-year lifetime limit on cash receipt. And in addition to that, we're going to develop a model called Work First, which means that individuals are automatically shoveled into work, not necessarily good or decent jobs, not necessarily jobs that pay good wages, not necessarily jobs that are very stable. But the idea is to get people into any job as fast as possible. And so what has happened as a result is that a lot of people have been pushed from welfare to work, but they have had a great deal of difficulty staying there. As the economy has weakened in the early part of 2000, we saw a lot of people struggling to get by, and the situation has only gotten worse since then. In terms of the racial dynamics associated with welfare reform, we've seen a dramatic change in the makeup of the welfare rolls. Prior to welfare reform, we had a lot of discussion about so-called welfare queens in the media, and oftentimes they were portrayed as some loud, some disruptive African-American woman with 10 or more children, with 10 or more fathers, someone who's just basically bilking the system. Of course, that was complete mythology. If you actually looked at the welfare rolls prior to welfare reform, the majority of adult welfare recipients were, in fact, white women, and the majority of welfare recipients only had about 2 children, and the majority of welfare recipients only utilized welfare for a very small, finite period of time. What has happened since welfare reform, however, has been a browning of the welfare rolls, is what I would call it. It seems as if white women have found it easier to make that transition from welfare to work than have black and brown women. And part of the research in that area suggests that white women tend to have better access to critical supports that make it easier for them to transition to a life of work. For example, they find it easier to get access to things like child care assistance, transportation assistance, things like job training. Those sort of avenues are opened up to them in a way that it seems is not the case when it comes to women of color. So that has left us with a situation where, yes, we've seen dramatic drops in the welfare rolls, but of those who have been able to make it, it seems as if we have a very skewed way in terms of helping people to get there. And even those who have gotten there haven't been able to get there securely in terms of having access to good-paying jobs with good wages and access to benefits and stability.
More and more, I have seen the struggle in New York City for women who are trying to get an education and are on the public assistance rolls. They've been forced out of the school system. Clearly, the role of higher education is strategic towards self-sufficiency. And what are your concerns about the lack of opportunity and access to higher education?
You know, to me, that is probably the biggest injustice to come out of the rules changes surrounding welfare reform. Under welfare reform, it has become exceedingly more difficult for individuals to have access to higher education. In fact, tens of thousands of individuals across the nation had to drop out of college once welfare reform was in fact enforced because of that workforce emphasis that I spoke about a moment ago. And to me, it seems not only counterintuitive, but an example of a total lack of common sense, because we all know in this society, and the legislators know, that in order to be able to have access to true economic well-being in today's economy, one must have access to a higher education. They have put that mindset into place in their own lives. They certainly put that mindset into place with regards to their own children. But when it comes to women struggling to make ends meet, struggling to make a better life for themselves and their children, all of a sudden that logic goes out the window and they say, oh, well, you need to get a job, any job, no matter how bad the job is. Once again, it's counter to what we know, not only in terms of our intuitive nature, but also in terms of fact. Having a college degree is extremely important in terms of being able to get a decent job, especially for women. And if you look at the welfare rolls, 90% of the adult caseload are women. So it's especially critical that they have access to higher education. Just to give you one very quick example, if you take a man and a woman with a high school degree, both with a high school degree, a woman is 40% more likely to live in poverty than her male counterpart. Now, if that woman and the man were to have both a college degree, their chances of living in poverty are almost equal and especially and very small, at only about 2% each. That makes a huge difference. The reason why we see those types of differences is because the types of jobs that women tend to get without a college degree are very unstable, low-wage jobs. So it's especially important for women to have access to a college degree. And for those women who achieve a bachelor's degree under welfare reform, they have an 88% chance of never, ever in their lives going back on welfare. To me, the best investment that we can make in terms of really giving people access to self-sufficiency, in terms of really opening up doors to a better future for women and their families, is to invest that time that they would have been spending on and off of low-wage jobs instead in a college classroom so that they can obtain that degree and really create a better life for themselves.
Few people realize that nearly two-thirds of welfare recipients are victims also of domestic violence. One-third of them are currently being abused and depend on public assistance to help them escape to safety and rebuild their lives. Well, now, instead of receiving the help they need to recover from the abuse and become self-sufficient through education, as just referenced, domestic violence, mental health, and substance abuse services, they will be encouraged to participate in programs that will prolong their involvement with and make them more economically dependent upon their abusers. Do you find that also documented within your studies? Because certainly in my experience, I've seen that very much.
Definitely. We've done some work where we've looked at women in California specifically who have tried to escape poverty through access to higher education, and we've heard story after story after story of women basically ending up in this catch-22 because of being in an abusive relationship. And this was the only avenue they had in terms of having some level of economic independence as they tried to transition away from that abusive relationship. What's really disturbing to me in terms of how welfare reform has been structured, and particularly the recent reauthorization of welfare reform, is the fact that the only level where we saw an increased investment in terms of the money allocated for this line of spending was not in areas that people would need it, such as job training, would not be in areas such as child care, but instead was in the area of marriage promotion, which I am particularly wary of, primarily because of that domestic violence component. Instead of investing in areas where we might say, let's do a better job of screening women when they come in to make sure that they are not victimized by domestic violence, and in fact, if they are, we can then do something quickly and swiftly about it, we're instead telling people to basically screen people about how is your relationship, basically. Do you think you might get married? And that might create a situation, I would argue, that would make it even more difficult for a woman to be able to leave her abuser. Our priorities, frankly, are backwards in this sense. We need to make sure that a woman's safety is paramount, and also that we provide her with the tools that she needs to be able to become economically viable and independent. And if at that point she makes the independent decision that she chooses someone who is good to her, who will supplement her life in some way that she would feel would maybe make it easier for her to grow as a person and then chooses to marry, that's her business. That's not anything I think that the government needs to get involved in at all.
Well, we have to leave it there. Dr. Avis Jones-DeWeaver, we thank you for your efforts. And Dr. DeWeaver is Director of Poverty Education and Social Justice Programs at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. You've been listening to Building Bridges, your community and labor report.